thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
720 WGN and a happy Wednesday afternoon, everybody. As you can tell, this isn't John Williams. This is John Hanson filling in until 3 o'clock today. And that'll take us right up to Rowan Anna. And, of course, they will jump in with the rest of the broadcast as soon as White Sox and postgame is over. We appreciate you joining us everywhere across the world, streaming live here from Chicago. Elif, a happy Wednesday to you. You said to me in the room that, hey, it's almost Friday. That's thinking very optimistically.
I am just the queen of optimism.
I like that. Today. I like that. If any, today. Specifically today. Mm-hmm. Other days, not so much. Laura Lapka is in the traffic center, still keeping abreast of what's going on with, even though we're here on the stream. Laura, how you doing?
I'm doing good. And of course, plenty of things going on always. So.
Of course. It's never a dull moment. Anytime. No. I used to do traffic and, I did afternoons and I felt so, I wish I was a morning person. It's so compact during that time.
Oh my
it's
goodness.
6 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. And obviously you get delays after that. Mm-hmm. But man, the afternoon drive, that is a busy one. Yeah. The entire time.
My dad has asked me, do you think there will be a day where there's never an accident? And I just laughed.
Oh, gosh.
I just laughed.
Right. Will there ever be an hour? Probably not.
No, probably not.
All right. We're going to jump right into things here. The big story this week has been the president in the UK for his state visit and all the interesting things that have come out of that, from awkward handshakes to discussions of London's mayor and whether Theresa May is a better negotiator than Donald Trump, even though I imagine people would disagree that either one of them can negotiate much of anything in terms of political things, but I'm sure you have disagreements. Feel free to text me, by the way, those disagreements or agreements at 312-981-7200, or give us a call to join the conversation. I had a chance to interview Valerie Jarrett this morning on The Jam. It was a great interview, but I'm still more excited to talk to Fred Weintraub. Fred, you're joining us from Singapore to talk about London. We do whatever we can here to make it work on WGN.
John, it's already Thursday morning here in Singapore, but happy Wednesday afternoon to you, sir.
I appreciate that. Fred, you traveled the globe, of course, and one of the places that you call home is London, and obviously it's been a huge week in London with the president's second visit to the country. In terms of setting up this visit, did you think there was a little less hype going into this one than the previous one since he had done it before, or do you think that the circumstances around Brexit made this equally as compelling for all of us around the world?
Well, as you know, John, the first visit was more of just kind of a business trip over and was not an official state visit. What's kind of unusual is that there would be a second visit so quickly, but there's so many parts of a moving puzzle, including the fact that from the UK's standpoint, Brexit is falling apart depending on which side you're on. The Queen met with Trump last time in 2018, unofficially at Windsor Castle. That did not go overly well, not because they had a poor conversation, but because President Trump didn't, by all appearances, follow protocol. So when you see them, when you saw them at Windsor Castle a year ago, you saw that he walked in front of the Queen.
Yes.
And the Queen's not very tall, and so you usually don't do those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But then Theresa May, who is now the outgoing Prime Minister of the UK, she invited him for an official state visit, of which the Queen is the person that first meets with whoever is coming to the UK on an official level. So he has spent the last 3 days getting all the pomp and circumstance that you can imagine, just like any state official would throughout the world. So it's not a surprise that this is happening. It's a little bit of a surprise that it's happened so closely. But the big question is, did it go well? Did it not go well? Were there any major faux pas? And as you know, and as everybody knows, if you listen to the radio or have been watching the wall-to-wall television coverage, and Americans are, anytime the royals are involved, whether it's a royal wedding or whether there's some real news to be made, they're glued to their television.
Oh, yeah.
So they literally saw 3 days worth of, first day was total pomp and circumstance, second day was politics, today was about D-Day, and if you look from a journalistic standpoint, It's all about a big photo op for the President of the United States, of which he brought his entire family to. And the Queen did what the Queen does better than anyone else in the world. When a government is falling apart, including her government, she knows what she needs to do and what her royal family needs to do to keep the glue together. And they did that for the first three days that the president was in the UK.
Yeah.
And now he's in Ireland.
I wonder, you know, it's interesting you mention about whether, you know, is this the worst time that for Britain to have a visit? Or counter, could this be something that, like you said, holds the glue together for just a little bit? Certainly, it's got to be one of the more awkward times for a state visit, especially with your, quote-unquote, closest ally.
I think it is. You know, it's got to be an awkward time because Theresa May is on her way out, so obviously she's a lame duck.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're the queen, I don't think you look at it as Donald, whether you're a fan of Donald Trump, not a fan of Donald Trump, you don't look at it that way when you're the queen. You look at it as just as she represents Britain and the other realms that she is responsible for, she is paying her respects not to a human being, i.e. this particular president, but to the government of the United States of America. And that's probably why it worked out as well as it did.
I got to ask,
in front of the cameras.
I got to ask, Fred, yeah, and let's talk about behind the cameras, the discussions that can be had. When you have a prime minister that's on their way out, who, I mean, is it a matter that departmental officials are meeting with their counterparts on the same level across the pond in terms of getting things done? Because the president, he's not going to negotiate much with Theresa May. He knows she's on the way out. Are there talks of them negotiating with people underneath or people that could potentially be the next prime minister? How hard is that to navigate for someone not knowing who the next leader of the country is going to be and the fact that that change is going to happen sooner rather than later?
Well, I think when you're Donald Trump, you are narrowly focused on what you perceive that you want to have happen. So he said publicly that he's all about trade negotiations. Now, the reality is there can't be any trade negotiations right now because we don't know what side of where Brexit is going to ultimately fall. We don't know who the next prime minister is. So nothing consequential probably got done during the state visit.
Yeah. We got to talk about today, I think, the D-Day visit. If there's one thing that can unify world leaders and unify us all, it's paying tribute to the troops from many countries who landed on the beaches of Normandy on June 6, 1944. So many years ago, I can't do the math. This is 75? Yeah, it's the 75th anniversary
years.
Tomorrow. Yeah.
And especially when you have a queen who's 93 years old. So that is her generation. So
yeah.
If you had an opportunity to see any of the B-roll this morning on the jam of the ceremony that was taking place, you had 10 representatives that were all 90-plus years old that walked out, that fought in Normandy. And if anyone can relate to what they went through, it's the queen because she is of their generation. And if there's anything that Brits like better, it's paying respect to past wars where Britain has been successful, where they can show pride. And really, 15 world leaders came out from, you know, Merkel in Germany to the president of France to all pay homage. So it turned out to be, whether it was planned this way or not planned this way, it turned out to be pretty heartfelt, and the Queen led the entire event.
Fred Weintraub is the WCIU Royal Correspondent for the Jam. Also pinch hits with Hannah Staley here on WGN-AM. Hey, Fred, you know, we talk about the protests and Donald Trump saying that most of it was fake news. He saw some little protests, but the rest of it was fake news. I don't know if you've seen any context in terms of how many people were out there, whether it compares to the first visit or not. But certainly from my eyes and B-roll, there certainly were some pretty massive protests.
Yeah, there were protests. And the definition of fake news is, you know, I'm not sure what Donald Trump's definition of fake news is.
News he doesn't like.
Clearly, if you look at it from a journalistic standpoint, there were protests. Now, when Donald Trump says he didn't see any, he probably saw some out of the corner of his eye, but they are so strategic. And this is true when any president comes to London, that they close off the roads to a point where the presidential motorcade is only going to pass through particular intersections that are closed off. So he probably didn't see a lot, but there were big protests in near Parliament. Now, were they massive protests with a million people? No, I don't think so. But when you see the balloon up in the air, that is a representation of Trump as a baby, and you see people being interviewed that say that they don't like the fact as Brits that they're using taxpayer money to roll out the red carpet for a president that they don't respect, you know, they're entitled to their opinion. Yeah. And so, yes, the answer to your question is there were protests. Did they stop action in the middle of the street? Did the president's motorcade get stopped anywhere along the way? It's no different with any president, at least that I've seen. And I've only seen Clinton, Obama, and I haven't actually been in London when Trump's been there. Mm-hmm. But they keep you and the journalists and the people so far away that, you know, you're not going to see very much, which is so different than how they treat their own queen. Because I can tell you, as a journalist and as someone who's just interested in royal history, in the years that I've lived part-time in London, if you're strategic, you can get pretty close up to the queen. Not close up like you can say hello to her, but you're not blocks away. You're literally, you can get, if you have a good camera, you can get great shots of the royal family. So they operate in a totally different, in a different scenario.
The president, I think that we haven't seen too many, I hate to call them blunders or whatever they were. There was the awkward fist bump, but, you know, that the whole, that all that courtesy is tough. And I have awkward handshakes and fist bumps with everyone every single day. Not going to blame him on that. People are making a big ruckus about the fact that he brought his adult sons that aren't a part of the administration's to a state thing. That doesn't bother me really at all in the slightest. I guess you could say if you had to rate the president on his visit, just from reports, what would you give it a grade, or what sort of rating would you give it if we had to rate these things?
I mean, if I were rating it on a photo op, how he appeared, how his manners were with the queen, you know, I would give him an A minus. If you're weighing him on concrete things that he helped resolve, like climate control and economic issues, I don't think any of that got done. But in fairness to this president, who clearly likes to communicate personally with his feelings, he went on Piers Morgan's show, and when Piers kind of pressed him as to what did you and the Queen talk about, he was very good about saying, you know what, I promise to keep those conversations confidential, and I'm going to keep them confidential. Now, where he had blunders were before he even got on the plane to go to London, he was already saying nasty things about Meghan Markle, which didn't come across very well.
Right.
And there's no love lost between the mayor of London and Donald Trump. So they got in it via sound bites and Twitter. Was that overly helpful? Probably not. But the minute his plane touched down, the minute he got in Marine One, the minute Marine One got to the back of Buckingham Palace, he did exactly what he needed to do. And the few times when he was veering in the wrong direction, his wife veered him back in the right direction, because they were in Buckingham Palace, and I think I read somewhere that the Queen asked him about a particular gift, which he, i.e. the United States, gave to the Queen. He didn't remember that, but his wife did, and she piped right in and said, no, this was a gift from us.
Oh, that's
so
good.
All in all, from a photo op standpoint, probably from what President Trump wanted to achieve, which was to come across as respectful to, you know, to the most photographed, probably the most respected queen in the world. He did all those things. Did he accomplish anything long term? No. Did he put his foot in his mouth when he talked about, you know, we'll have trade, you know, we'll have a trade deal and everything's on the table, including national health care in the UK? Well, national health care in the UK is not on the deal, and right, not going to be part of a trade agreement, because it can't be, because you can't negotiate for another country. Right. And he backstepped on that, and you know, and that's the way this president appears to work in many instances.
So where we are with Brexit, man, it was hard to keep track of all the deals and how many deadlines there were and the different proposals that were all shot down by Theresa May's the parliament. Where are we at now? I mean, are they in risk of, you know, being either kicked out of the EU without an agreement? Or are they going to, is anyone considering calling a second referendum just to negate this whole thing? Is Brexit even popular anymore? Like, where are we at with Brexit moving forward?
So my Geiger counter, the way I really tell what's going on is, the first thing I do when I get back into London is I take a cab somewhere and I start talking to the cab drivers, because they, particularly in London, they love to talk and they all have an opinion. Now, the opinion right now is that they're so sick of that, no matter whether you're a Brexiteer, whether you're pro, whether you're con, you know, this whole process started in 2016, and they're still not anywhere. So cab drivers will tell you, we just want to move this thing along in some direction.
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, Theresa May got into office. She thought she could bring it through. Three times she tried to push something through Parliament. It didn't work. She got an extension for Brexit. Now, officially, they have until, I believe, October 31st to come up with some type of deal to either get out of, you know, to try to get out of the EU in a way that will be good for Britain.
Is there a call for another amendment, or is there worry that the precedent that would send for future amendments and legislation from that the people want? I mean, you can't just go back on everything you do. I mean,
yeah. If the question is, could they go back and just vote again?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they probably could do that. But a new prime minister who's got to pretty much be in by the end of the summer knows that in order to keep the UK from falling apart or being so unstable as it is from an economic standpoint, that they've got to do something. So, you know, no one really knows what the answer is, because right now they're fighting over who's going to be the prime minister, and they'll narrow that down from probably 16 candidates down to two. Then there'll be a vote, and then they'll figure out which way they're going to go. But considering that they haven't been able to figure it out over a 3-year period of time, it's going to be a tough thing to do. And I would say that as you look and evaluate economic turmoil around the world in sophisticated countries, this is as messy as it gets. And stay tuned for the soap opera, because it's going to get a lot more interesting, and it doesn't help their economy.
Well, you're going to be the one to break it all down for us. You can follow Fred, obviously, on WCIU, the Jam. He's our royal correspondent. Also, a pinch hits with Hannah Stanley here on WGN, and you can get Fred at GabbyRoad.com. Fred, happy Thursday. Get to bed.
I will do so. John, nice talking to you as always.
You as well. I really appreciate it. Fred Weintraub is a stand-up gentleman, a scholar. Thank you very much, Steve. 720 WGN. We're streaming everywhere live from Chicago. And joining us, as he always does on Wednesdays, is Phil Vitale, Chicago Tribune restaurant critic. We're going to be talking about summer eats. We're going to talk about Phil's flash fry, of course. But we were just talking baseball. Phil. And I don't know if many people know, you were born in the Bronx, so you were a Yankees fan as a kid, yeah?
Growing up, yeah. Yankees fan.
Going to the old games?
Could go back then, yeah. It was very inexpensive to go. And, I mean, literally true. I didn't have very much / any money growing up as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't have So the days we decided that, you know, my buddies and I were going to the game, I would be up extra early scouring the alleys for soda pop bottles.
Really?
Yeah.
Would you be able to, oh, for just the change to be able to get right. in for $1.50?
Right. So, you know, you bring the bottles back the regular bottles were 2 cents, and the fatter bottles were good for a nickel, and you just, you know,
you got as many as you can.
Took them to the grocery store, got my $2, and yeah, it cost about $1.50 to get into the park. It was I don't remember the subway fare because we didn't pay it.
Right. Would you just hop on?
Yeah, we just jumped the turnstile. You just
how do you like our producer engineer Ella here, by the way?
And
she's
handyman,
in here fixing your
yes. Awesome. She is getting my sound level because I'm not able to do it all by myself.
You're already on WGNRadio.com. Check out the stream of Ella moving that microphone. No, you sound great, Phil.
Thank you.
Ella's just making sure you sound as crystal clear as possible. Mm-hmm. But yeah, going to those games at Yankee Stadium, you probably saw some incredible ball players.
Yeah, that was the Mickey Mantle years. That was Joe Pepitone. It was starting in the decline.
Yeah.
So sometimes it would be, you know, your infield third to first would be Jerry Kenney and Ruben Amaro and Horace Clark, and then maybe Joe Pepitone at first.
Right.
Not your
lineup. Not your Bronx Bombers.
Well, they used to. The joke with Jerry Kenney is that the people in the first base side boxes always brought their gloves.
Yes.
because
you never
that
knew.
Throw from third was
you
better be
throw.
Ready.
You better be
yeah.
ready for that one. Exactly. Do you make it back to New York very often?
Not Check very it. Often. No, I would go often when the James Beard Award were held in New York City. I'd get to go there every year for that, and then Chicago stole them
right.
and locked it down. So I don't know if I doubt it'll ever be back in New York. And
right.
So now it's a Chicago thing. So one of my biggest reasons for going to New York was taken away because it got to be heat.
Well, we love it here, of course.
I much prefer it.
Yeah,
here.
Right. You don't have to go anywhere.
Sleep
now.
In my own bed.
Yes.
It's wonderful.
So you were in your early teens in New York, and we're talking about summer eats, and you know that makes me mm-hmm. think of sort of that outdoor food and getting excited for that feeling of being able to sit on a patio and enjoy it. When you were a 13, 14 year old kid eating whatever you were eating at a baseball game, you ever think you'd be a 30-year critic for the Chicago Tribune?
No.
How did you end up on that? I'm sure you've told John Williams or other people that, and maybe our listeners have heard the story before, but I'd love to hear it. Yeah. How do you get there?
Well, I was hired by the Chicago Tribune as a general assignment reporter, and I worked for the paper for 10 years, first in the Suburban Bureau and then down downtown in the feature section, and an old section we had called Friday,
mm-hmm.
where I had a little column, and that's where the dining coverage went as well, and the critic at the time was Paul Camp, and he would let me pinch hit every now and then, particularly for the twice annual dining guides. He would look at what we had. We'd have little blurbs of all the restaurants, and he'd think, we don't have a lot of German restaurants in this list. So he would give me a couple of $100, and I would eat at German restaurants nonstop for about 2 weeks and write up the blurbs and help flesh things out that way. And so, yeah, it was a long time before I was entrusted with assigning stars to anything, but
mm-hmm.
I had that background, and then one day they called me into the office and offered me the big gig.
Thing.
Yeah.
Wow. And you haven't looked back since?
Up to management, and they were looking, he put me in the job.
That's awesome. All right, what's our required eating here this week? I see a Stephanie Izzard thing here.
Yep. That's already hot because she has opened Cabra, which is Spanish for goat, because there's the word goat in every one
Everything,
of the restaurants.
Yeah.
Because Izzard is a breed of goat.
Did I say Izzard? I meant Izzard.
Everybody
My
does.
Apologies. Yeah,
yeah
mm-hmm.
but it's a breed of goat native to the Pyrenees, so all her restaurants have had the word goat in it.
And this is at the Hoxton Hotel.
Yes.
And I work at the WCIU for my morning show gig, and I was supposed to go there today on my live shot, but then I got moved into the studio. Anyways,
mm-hmm.
our good friend Justin Roman got to go there today and check out all sorts of things at the Hoxton. Oh, what a gorgeous facility that is.
Yeah, it's very, very, very cool and very hip. And, you know, they have a downstairs restaurant called Syrah, which
mm-hmm.
is also very good. That's
yep.
Mediterranean. And then Stephanie has the 12th floor rooftop restaurant called Cabra. And there she's playing with Peruvian influences. But you've got the roof. It's not completely open air. In fact,
mm-hmm.
it has a roof over most of it. But that's also where the hotel pool is, oddly enough. And it's got a full-service bar right there.
Oh.
So you can get your ceviche and
Take
maybe a
nice...
Right, a pisco sour, or watch, people better looking than you who might be taking a swim, which is more than half the fun of a pool for me anymore.
Amen. It's all about viewing there. Absolutely. When you get towards summer, do you look forward to the summer season? Do a lot of the restaurants do a real clear out of the menu and give out some new fresh things?
Well, yeah, and a lot of restaurants time their openings. I mean, you don't want to miss this, you know, huge cash flow that is the summer season in Chicago when everybody's going out and there are more tourists here than any other time of year, and you want to be ready. So
yeah.
We have all these restaurants that I do this every year, list the restaurants that recently opened, that are just about to open, and that are really kind of hoping to open pretty soon.
I'm sure you've been told that a few times. Soon.
Well, sure.
Two more weeks.
I remember one restaurant, they were all set to go. They had their inspections, and there was a dock strike in L.A., and their furniture was sitting in a container somewhere. And with the dock strike, nobody could empty the container, their furniture sat there.
Imagine getting through the city, getting through the permits, the red tape, all that, and then your furniture sitting on a dock.
Chicago makes you go through a few hoops, and, you know, considering what things can go wrong in restaurants, I don't exactly blame them.
Yes, exactly.
But the background, especially if you're going to try to sell alcohol, the background checks are thorough, and you have to meet a lot of rules and regs, and then you've got the plumbing, and you've got the heating and the ventilation.
Oh, so many things.
It's got to be ready.
Then you need your furniture. Okay, let's talk about. Oh, I'm going to butcher all these names, Phil. I hope you're okay with that. Is it Aboye, Aboyer? Did I get it? Aboye?
Yeah, Aboye.
Because it's French, then, right?
It is French.
Tell us about it.
Aboye is a kind of bustling brasserie kind of concept. It just opened. I haven't been there yet. Up in Winnetka. This is by Michael Lagowitz, who has George Trois, which is a 4-star restaurant, says meat. And under what he had is he had George Trois and his other original restaurant Michael, under the same roof in this building in Winnetka. And then a few months back, he shut the whole thing down, turned Michael into two spaces. Aboye is the first one, and the other one is Silencieux, which means
I'm glad you said it. Yes, right, silence, be
French
quiet.
For be quiet. And as the name suggests, Silencieux is going to be the more laid-back, the much more quiet, but not super pricey. He just wanted to establish a small, quiet room because, as you probably know, small, quiet rooms are pretty scarce anymore.
Yes. Oh, I know. You know, it's interesting. We had an acoustic engineer or scientist on one of the programs I hosted recently talking about he does some of the work for a lot of the new, I forget which one's off the top of my head, you know, the new strip of restaurants in the Hotel Zachary by Wrigley Field.
Oh, sure.
And he
did
a lot of the acoustics behind that because, obviously, you're talking about massive crowds going in there and really trying. I mean, this is a new focus for restaurants, is to really create an atmosphere that isn't so damn loud. I mean, it's dangerous at a certain point.
Right. And as the population ages just a bit, there are people closer to my age maybe than their target demographic right now, but are starting to I don't need it quite so noisy. I mean, my sons are right around 30 and noise doesn't bother them at all.
Right.
But in 5 years, and these restaurants hope to serve them for the next 5 years.
Exactly.
At some point, it can be an issue. And then, of course, the older crowd, which they spend money and they come in different hours, and they take care of you on maybe a Wednesday night, which is really nice. You want to make it comfortable for them, too.
So yeah,
it's
difficult.
A delicate balance, especially because all the things that we tend to, that are hip for restaurants right now, the open kitchen, that means noise.
Right.
And the hard surfaces, that's noise.
Yeah.
Carpeting absorbs very well, but if
you
have
more carpeting,
and you're spilling on a carpet, that means you can rip that carpet up every 3 years,
right?
Because there's only so much a cleaning thing.
Exposed steel beams,
exactly.
And you know, not having the low ceiling,
and big ceilings, and the one room concept.
Yeah,
I remember, it must have been about 10, 12 years ago. One of my colleagues, new colleague, was here, and we went out to a restaurant, and it was one of these little reserved French restaurants done like as a salon, and there's long drapery, and there's wallpaper, and all the rest of it. And she looked around and wondered and said, "You can't even tell where the kitchen is." And I said, you know, there was a time when that was the point.
Yes, absolutely. Going down on this list of summer eats, I'm not much of a foodie. We've talked about that. But I have been to Blackbird, and I really enjoyed it. So the folks behind that have come out with a new place, right?
Right. They're doing a French, coastal French, inspired by Paul Kahn's trip to France, and it's called Café Cancale. And Cancale is a region refers to Brittany, which is where That's where France gets most of its oysters.
Okay.
And so oysters are a big part of the focus, and then they have a lot of other seafood, and, you know, for just to make sure everybody's happy, there's a roasted chicken on there, and there's a steak frite, because you want to have that. But mostly, it's seafood, and it's right there at the corner where Damon and Milwaukee and North Avenue.
I was just going to say, it's in the
into each other.
This is like showing just how much Wicker Park has grown up in the last 10 or 15 years. Because you mentioned this restaurant, and it seems fancy, but of course they have a happy hour special for oysters. But this just shows you how this neighborhood is getting a little bit older, a little bit more sophisticated taste.
And it's on the north end, so you can lob a softball into Bucktown from there.
Don't try it.
You're right on the edge. Not to hit somebody. It's constantly crowded.
Right.
But yeah, that's a place that they had for a while called Publican Anchor, and they just kind of switched what they had in there and made this, because Paul got into the seafood in a big way, and for all the Blackbird restaurants, they really didn't have anything with a dedicated seafood focus, and now they do.
All right, you mentioned Siri. You teased us on up 200 seats right at the Hoxton.
Yeah, that's going to be nice. That's a big place. It's right off the lobby. The Hoxton, the way they designed it, the lobby just kind of flows into the dining room and all the rest. There's not a formal lobby per se. There's a bar, and there's a small desk where you can check in, but there's not one of these long desks with five people in crisp uniforms waiting to check you in. No, it's a little more mellow than that.
All right, the next one we have here is, Entente?
Entente. That's actually not a new restaurant. It's only a new location.
Oh, okay.
They got a Michelin star when they were way north on Lincoln Avenue, and they decided to come down where they'd be, probably where they'd get more business travelers and more business people that way. And so they're in River North, just west of Orleans, and they got a very pretty space. It's much, much larger, but they didn't add that many more seats.
Okay.
So as a consequence, the spacing is very, very comfortable.
That's nice.
You get your table, and you're not overhearing the inappropriate conversation at the table next to you, thank goodness.
Or even the appropriate conversation. That's boring. I don't want to hear that. Come on, give me the inappropriate one.
I'm sure your kid is beautiful. Shut up. Trying to have my food.
As I look through this list, you're doing your work here, Phil. Do you have any one or two posts or ones that you want to make sure we get to here before we break?
Yes, absolutely. The ones that are already open, Galit on Lincoln Avenue, 2400 block. That is Middle Eastern and a strong Israeli component there. Chung, which we've talked about before, on 1460 West Chicago, which is Korean-American, or what, say, a young... well-trained, classically trained chef interprets the food of his ancestors, of his parents. I like those a lot. Ocean Prime, which is right down the block here, right at the corner of Michigan Avenue and Wacker.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of throwing tennis balls. Yeah.
Right. That's the very, very ornate, very, very fancy, seafood restaurant. Keep your eye out for Gaijin, which is Paul Verrant, who he has V and Vistro out in the western suburbs. He had Perennial Verrant in the city. That's his little shop he's opening, focusing on okonomiyaki, which are little savory Japanese pancakes, and he does them in a whole bunch of different versions.
You have me at pancakes.
This is going to be very, very casual, very affordable. You're going to go in there, you're going to spend about $25 or something like that, and eat some very interesting foods.
I want to ask about Madden's Post, only because I live in the neighborhood, was just walking around and kind of peered in. It looked empty, but this was on an off day, early in the early evening, so I'm not saying that it should be packed or anything. Have you been into Madden's Post yet?
No. Okay. It's only been open for about, I want to say 10 days.
Or 2 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because they're trying to be more of a neighborhood restaurant rather than a Wrigley Field restaurant.
Right, even though it's right there. It's in the building attached to the offices.
Right, but it actually backs up to the park, so it's probably the only new restaurant that is opened in that area that you can't see the stadium from.
Right.
You're looking out. You're kind of looking northwest.
Yeah, you're looking northwest over on Racine. Yeah.
Right. But what they have is they have a big hearth in there, so they're doing a lot of hearth cooking. They're going to be doing ribs on an open fire, things like that, and they're doing a lot of pasta. And because of Joe's upbringing in Pennsylvania, there's going to be kind of a Polish influence there, here and there.
Did you ever try his spaghetti sauce, by the way?
No.
I know he's selling it in Jewel. He pawned one off on me. I haven't had it yet, though.
All right.
I mean, I'll always try spaghetti sauce.
Sure, why not?
All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break. 312-981-7200 for Phil's Flash Fry. We'll also talk more about these summer eats, so hang tight and more here on 720 WGN. I mean, it ended up being a gorgeous day, Phil Vitale, here. Not that you're a weather critic, but...
Yep.
ended up being a gorgeous day here, but man, we had to deal with it with those storms this morning. Did you wake up in the middle of the night?
Yes. Yes,
oh, I sure
I
heard did.
I slept with the window open because I can.
Right.
And yeah, so the thunderstorms kind of got me early.
Yeah.
And then
sure
I heard
did.
The rain coming down, and yep.
Eating outside will be something to do. Not every restaurant, of course, has outdoor seating. Do you like eating outdoors?
I like it a little. It really depends on the atmosphere.
Yeah.
The whole idea of a sidewalk cafe is sort of a been there, done that for me. You're like, oh boy, resin furniture and,
right.
and napkins blown away.
Mm-hmm.
And is that a bus?
Right.
It smells good.
Right,
so
exactly.
So it depends on where you are and what they are. There's some places that do, you know, of course, the rooftops are completely the rage now. Everybody's building rooftops, and the ones that don't are crying because they can't do it. And,
right.
Or even just little, you know, little backyard patios, little places like that. For, you know, say Piccolo Sonio out on Halstead Street with the, Tony's got this outdoor patio that he's landscaped and has inside lights. He's got real tall fencing. So you're sitting out there and it doesn't occur to you for a second that you're at the intersection of Halstead
right.
and Grand.
Right.
And
one
Milwaukee.
Of the busiest intersections
exactly.
there is.
Exactly. And, but it doesn't feel like that.
That's interesting.
It feels kind of nice. So that's one of my favorites. Duck Inn down in Bridgeport.
Yeah.
You know, Kevin Hickey's got that outside thing. It's, and you know, they can't fit that many people in there. So it's kind of nice when you get to go because
yeah.
it's very cool.
Yeah. I like drinking outside. I don't know about eating mm-hmm. outside. Sometimes I get the flies.
That's what ballparks are for.
Yes, exactly.
Drinking
that's
outside.
That's about it. Yeah. I was talking also, I know we got to get more Russians. I'm just so fascinated in the career of a food critic about, and I asked you, you know, you're going to be traveling a little bit at the end of the month. Do you ever get to turn it off, or are you at every restaurant, you're nitpicking everything you see just because you can't, even if you're not on the clock?
Yeah, no, you never stop the analysis. It's always looking at that. If I'm out of town and theoretically just relaxing, I'm still looking at what they're doing to see if a restaurant's doing something that Chicago isn't doing.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's, you know, just how does it fit in the grand scheme of things?
Right.
And I get to vote on the James Beard Awards. So if I'm out of town, I might be at a restaurant that would be
theoretically
nominated.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a year or two, so I should know, I should pay attention.
That's a good call.
I do.
Do your friends cook for you or no?
A couple do.
Okay. Couple.
Yeah.
And that's it?
And that's it.
Okay. Are you critical of them?
No, I want to be invited back.
Yeah, exactly. I love a good pizza during the summer,
mm-hmm.
especially like a nice thin crust one. We love our deep dish
yep.
here, but something nice, crispy, nice thin crust. You know, you can eat a little bit of it at a time, you know, space your time out. Any recommendations for that here in the summer on your summer eats?
Well, one of the new ones that opened is Robert's Pizza and Dough Company. It's right on in the River East Arts Center. If you're as old as me, you remember that was North Pier,
mm-hmm.
Right at the corner. Of it's at McClurg and in Illinois, although Roberts' main entrance is on that little promenade that follows Ogden Slip,
mm-hmm.
and you can get in that way. And he is this guy has spent a good part of his life learning the intricacies of pizza and studied with some of the great pizzaiolos in America. And he makes a really really fine pie. And he had a little place in Streeterville, and then there was a landlord problem, and that went away, and it took him a while to build out this space, but now he's there. And what I really like is it's right next door to Winter's Jazz Club.
Oh.
So I can have my pizza and wine, and as the evening starts getting late, then I can go next door and have some jazz.
Oh, that sounds
which
wonderful.
Is, really, you know, you're right on the river, or that little spit of the
slip,
lake, really.
Yeah, exactly.
The slip. Yeah, it's very cool.
I'll have to park my brother's boat there and go out there, because
mm-hmm.
I don't have my own boat, but that's the best thing ever, having the brother that has
oh,
one.
Oh, yeah, that should be one.
Oh, wonderful. I get to be a boat person and never take it out of the water. one other one I saw just as I was scanning through your list, a restaurant with its own flower shop.
Yeah, that is a very strange. I'm still waiting to see how that's going to open.
Yeah, like an actual flower shop to purchase.
An actual flower shop, and they're going to have
because I know Maria's Liquor in Bridgeport, you can do there's the liquor store, and then
right.
you have the bar.
Right.
Side
back. By
yeah,
side.
It kind of makes sense.
You're right. Now, I have that. But Machine, which opened in a month or two ago, they have a flower cart that goes into the restaurant. So if you want, you can order some flowers, and then you have flowers on your table. And
oh.
when your dinner's over, you take the flowers with you because you paid for them.
Have you ever heard of anything like that?
I have not. I'm eager to get in there and see if anyone's actually doing that.
Right.
And how much fun it is. And you know, that's great. It's really good because you're sitting there with your significant other, and significant other
yes.
says, this is our anniversary. Uh-huh. And you're like, I think I didn't know that? Hey, yes. Flower Boy, over here.
Or, yeah, first date. What
Here's
a great way
surprise.
To impress someone.
Exactly, right. I didn't bring flowers. I didn't carry flowers. I came to the flowers, and these are for you.
Some people might think of that as a silly little novelty, but, man, with so many restaurants to choose from, anything that gets someone in the door to try something out
right.
new is, and they have to be Instagrammable, every restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
It's
got
to have this experience. That could be the thing that gets people in the door.
Right, and they're on Division Street, and so they're very, it's a very residential part of town, and so the flower shop may be self-sustaining anyway. I don't know what the competition for flowers is
right,
in
yeah.
that stretch.
Yeah, it's at 1800 Division or something
right,
like that,
it's,
Division
you know,
and
so,
Wood, yeah.
So there'd be a lot of people maybe
yeah,
that would
going on through.
Show up, at, or you go in there and you can get stuff to go.
Phil, thanks so much for stopping on
by.
I really appreciate it. Sorry I had so many questions about the Yankees and about your career as
that
a critic.
Happens.
I'm sure you're like, let's talk about the restaurants instead. I'm sure you'll talk to John next week, all right?
All righty then.
Take care.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Mm-mm. 720 WGN. John Williams out today, but he's going to be back tomorrow, which is certainly good news across the air, and we'll be happy to have him back. John Hanson here filling in until 3 o'clock, then Roe and Anna will take over here on the stream, and then, of course, when that White Sox game wraps on up, they'll be on the mothership. Okay, we're joined by Walter Jacobson. Walter, filling in for John here every now and then for the past couple weeks. It's been such a pleasure to get to chat with you and pick your brain. Thanks for, again, stopping on in here.
Well, thank you for asking me. I like chatting with you, too.
Every time we come on, my mother sends me a text, and she says, I cannot believe you're talking to the Walter Jacobson. So you got a big fan in Marcia, so there you go.
Hello, Marcia. Thank you.
There you go. Well, let's talk about what you got cooking, a story you've been working on, which if it's, you know, if your sources are true and this is something that is actively being discussed, this is big news.
Yeah, you can change. Anything can change within 5 minutes.
Right.
But I've been told by sources close to Mayor Lightfoot that she is, in fact, considering declaring bankruptcy.
For the city?
Yes.
Not right. personally, yes.
That would be next.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, that's a drastic, drastic step for her to take, and I know she wouldn't want to take it. Who would want to take it? It's probably the single worst thing a mayor or a governor or a president, well, not president, could do.
Right.
Declare bankruptcy. It puts the city and her in such a terrible hole.
Yeah, and it's almost admitting defeat at that point.
Well, it does, but it may be the only way out. This city is like $36 billion in debt and no way to get close to finding that kind of money with all kinds of just huge, amazingly big projects coming up that have to be paid for. You know, whether it's Lincoln Yards or whether it's investing in the neighborhoods that she's been talking about, hugely expensive things at a time when the city's on edge because of all of the Alderman Burke stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got to figure out a way. Her first budget's coming up right away. It's her next order of business after trying to stop the violence in the street. She's got to find some solutions, and maybe that's the only one.
We're kind of going down the Chicago River without an oar here, you and I. We're not financial experts, and we're not attorneys in that sense. I've done some limited reading about what that means for a city. It does not forgive the city of the debts. It has mandatory debts it would still have to pay off. But it's almost like a pause button, and it brings everyone to the table, creditors and who you owe and what you owe, and at least allows either payment plans or some way back. But it still holds you to have a balanced budget.
Yeah.
And so, while that may not seem so bad, Detroit did it. It took years to get out. I mean, they're still struggling with the ramifications of that.
Right.
I mean, it would be, I mean, this is where I think it would be a huge wake-up call, if nothing else. Even if we don't do it, if Lori Lightfoot at any point comes to a podium in the next couple of days, weeks, or months and says, this might be something we have to do, I mean, this is going to send off a lot of alarm bells.
Oh, there's no question about that, John. She'll have to make promises when she goes into bankruptcy court, if she in fact does. Promises that she will do things that will be sure that the city doesn't go even a dollar more deeper into debt. And she'll have to cut back. First of all, before even cutting back, she will have to impose tax hikes. Mm-hmm. Property tax hikes.
Got to get that revenue in,
yeah. Yeah, have to. And she, because they'll stop the protection that she gets from bankruptcy if she doesn't follow through on some of the ideas, hers or the courts, to keep the city out of debt or get the city out of debt and then keep out of debt. And if she doesn't do that with any degree of success, they'll just take away those protections. Yeah. And then she's back where she started.
Boy, it has ramifications. Again, this is early stages of these discussions, I imagine.
Absolutely.
And we're going to have to keep an eye on it. But from a micro level, the taxes, from a macro level, businesses that consider moving to Chicago, that certainly plays a role in their decisions. And then you start to have this sort of snowballing effect of confidence in what your city's economic outlook is, which could drive you further in the red.
That's right. And she's got, you know, the bonds, the city bonds are still in junk categories.
Yeah, so, who's going to lend the city money if it's bankrupt?
Can you imagine what's on her plate? Boy, you have to feel sorry for her. And she seems absolutely tireless.
Yeah.
She goes to events all day long, all week long, and she's saying and making promises about how she's going to fix things. And many of those things that she's going to fix, they're going to cost a lot of money.
Yeah. She mentioned, I think this was still during the transition between Mayor Emanuel and when she took over, but maybe the seeds of what you're talking about here today, I could see being planted in that when Mayor Emanuel said that this budget currently had a $700 million shortfall. Her team immediately came on and said, no, it is way deeper than that. Right. So in showing that this may not necessarily be something that she's come aware of as she's been mayor, but maybe something her and her team has been talking about for months.
Yeah, that's right. Could be. I don't know that.
Yeah,
and I don't know really to what degree she is serious. She may be considering every option possibly available to her, but I know that it's been on her list to talk about, and she'll have to make that decision soon.
Your sources that you've talked to, or the source that you've talked to, has there been any indication on the timing of when we might know more about this, or is it just something that's happening in private discussions right now?
The latter, for sure. John,
all right.
No timing. And they're making every effort to keep it out of the news because
yes.
They don't want people speculating about it. And my sources have made it very clear to me that this is purely speculative on her part,
mm-hmm.
as you just warned our listeners.
Right.
We can't spread the word because we don't know. I don't have any way to confirm it. It's a reasonable thing for her to think about.
I was going to say, I mean, I think maybe some people might be alarmist and say, I cannot believe this is even coming out of her mouth, that word, that dirty B-word of bankruptcy, but that's what an executive does. They've got to look at all options on the table and have frank discussions about them.
Yeah.
All right, Walter, anything else to add to this conversation, or are you going to go back to work on the story?
How are we feeling about Burke now that he's actually been in, about to get tried? July 2nd, he may be starting the trial, and they've got now 14 counts against him.
How does he stay in office? How does he weather the storm? Or is it a matter of he just had re-election, got well over 60% of the vote, and he's you almost want, if I'm trying to put myself in those shoes, which is impossible, but you want the protections at least, or the pulpit, to be able to continue to try your case, not only in court, but amongst your constituents. If you lose that, now you're fully exposed.
Well, and it's hard to find anybody in local politics now who think that he's going to get away with it.
Yeah.
He's 75 years old. Maybe the court will be easier on him than on others who are younger and can withstand the punishment of prison. And, you know, so as you and I discussed the other day, you know, when you're in politics for 50 years in this town and you get to know these people a little bit more on the inside, you have to have a bit of a feeling of sympathy for him.
Yeah. I see your heart is warming. Not that you'd ever be the Grinch, Walter, but I see it's like in the movie where the heart grows three times as big. I mean, you've been covering politics here forever. Have you always had this softer side, or has it come about through years of experience? I mean, when you were at Channel 2, would you be saying, oh, poor Walter Burke? No.
That's a very good and very fair question. And my answer to it is, with age, I'm going to be 82 in a month.
Wow.
With age, you know, your senses get a little more sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel for people you've been working with or at least working around. You know, I've noticed a lot of the headlines in the newspapers this past week. They're really rough. They are written by younger people, perhaps. Younger people who are reporting for the newspapers,
mm-hmm.
who know only the bad about Burke. Then you get some of us crotchety old timers, crotchety in the past. No, I wouldn't have been this soft when I was at Channel 2.
So you could be sympathetic to the reporters that see a story and are barking as hard as they can at it.
Oh, absolutely. Since Watergate, when every reporter wants to be a Watergate kind of guy, catch them doing things wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how we get our points.
But obviously we're so happy to have you here and working at WGN, offering your perspective. I'm happy to work on. I work on more of a lifestyle show, but we still have a newsroom. We still chase things. Do you miss the everyday chase? That really grindy. I mean, you're still breaking news here, approaching your 82nd birthday. But do you miss the daily? Gotta put that show on, no matter what.
No.
That show. No, you don't miss that.
I like the time to think a little bit more and look deeper into things rather than run around trying to catch the latest fact at the latest minute. But you know, I loved it all. You know,
yeah.
This is a wonderful profession we're in, this journalism. And you know, there's so much going on in Washington and watching Trump. I mean, there's nothing as interesting as what's going on with him,
right?
That's going on in Chicago, so I don't miss the daily stuff.
Yeah, Walter, thanks for stopping by as always.
John, thank you.
WGN, a happy Wednesday afternoon. The sun's shining bright, at least here downtown. Turned out to be a gorgeous day across the area, but we earned it after the rumbles of thunder through the overnight hours and into this morning as well. My good friend Heidi Stevens joins us now on WGN. Heidi, I knew that the next time we'd talk on the air, of course, it'd be about a straight pride parade.
Totally. Who did not see that coming?
Heidi, I thought it was just a joke on the internet, and that there was just some guy who was just kind of spouting off in Boston. You know, I hear this all the time when it comes to Pride Month. You can pretty much set your calendar or your watch to June comes, the rainbow flags come out on the internet, they come out on Facebook, they come out all over Chicago and cities across the world. And you can almost like set a bet for how long it's going to take for someone to say, well, when's straight Pride Month? And this one was pretty quick, about 11 hours until I saw this story pop up.
Yeah, and these guys seem kind of determined to make this happen. They're like talking about suing if they don't get the, you know, parade route okayed and don't get the permits in time. And so, you know, who knows what will come of that, but it's a little more than just, you know, your random Facebook post or tweet, one straight Pride Month. This one, you know, they're taking it a couple steps further.
Yeah, and I got to say, I love the organization group name. I'm with them on that.
Super Happy Fun America.
Yes.
How can you be anti Super Happy Fun America?
I mean, they picked a darn good name, I will say that.
Darn good name.
So, yeah, I saw this Facebook post. They're doing the route. And I guess, Heidi, before we dive into how absurd this is, at least in my opinion, I'm sure we have other opinions out there. You're welcome to join the conversation at 312-981-7200. This does bring up interesting First Amendment rights situations, I believe. I think that, you know, we are well, you know, versed in on this conversation about, you know, hey, if you organize, you stay safe, and you get all the documentation done, pretty much any group can have a parade if they like.
Yep. Yep. And I'm actually not writing to condemn, you know, a straight pride parade if they want to make it happen and people want to go. I guess fine. I just think it's redundant. I think the world is a straight pride parade. I think we have, you know, every single rom-com ever made and the entire Bachelorette franchise and women's magazines and men's magazines and the Kardashians and like total mania for royal weddings and like all that stuff is, you know, nothing if not like a feast of heterosexuality, right? I don't know that we're like not, you know, celebrating straight love kind of year round.
Right.
I think we actually are already.
And the roots of pride and the Pride Parade, of course, don't only come from a part of a point of pure pride and just being happy who you are, which of course straight people are more than happy to be who they are too, and that's great. It comes from a part of past oppression and suppression of rights. I mean, as all these movements come from, they come from a point of being second-class citizens.
Second-class citizens and made to feel that they should be ashamed of who they are, and pride is the opposite of shame, right? You're saying, I'm not actually ashamed of who I am at all. I'm quite proud of who I am. And, you know, there's also no shame in being straight, but no one is saying there is.
Right.
No one's trying to make you feel ashamed for being straight, so you don't actually need to throw yourself a parade out of your pride for overcoming the shame that you were actually never made to feel in the first place.
Yeah.
That's why I say it's just redundant. It's not like something we, you know, should feel fearful of. I don't think this is a situation of like Nazis trying to march in Skokie. I mean, I think it's a different level of absurd, but it still is absurd. Like, what has been taken from you that you need to reclaim and then feel proud of having overcome that oppression? I mean, straight people aren't discriminated against when they're seeking housing. They're not having to like sue bakeries to get wedding cakes made for them. I mean, it's just like, what are you overcoming?
Yeah. 412 texted in, gay pride and straight pride is just an excuse to party and get drunk on public streets. Enough is enough already. Before I to knock that text down, I'm sure I know people that, yes, it is a fun excuse to get drunk on the public streets. Not that you're supposed to drink or anything like that. But having marched in that parade, being gay myself, this will be the first time I'm married to a man and in the parade this year. There is a symbol, and I don't drink in it because I'm not allowed to, of course, on the company float. But like, I think someone like that messaging that, you're just completely missing the point. Well, I'm not saying that no one feels that way. I do feel like, I mean, come on, we're completely missing the point there.
Missing the point. Well, and also I think it's probably, I don't know that person, but it might be selective. Outrage is probably too strong a word, but
yeah.
Selective eye rolling anyway. I mean,
right.
I think the St. Patrick's Day parade certainly has an element of, you know, drinking on public streets.
Fair
and
point.
People coming out there who have zero Irish pride or know a single thing about who St. Patrick actually was. That isn't to say that there's no room for a St. Patrick's Day holiday or the marking of, you know, St. Patrick's Day as a, you know, an occasion for celebration or remembrance. I mean, just because, you know, elements of something get co-opted by people who kind of just want an excuse to party doesn't mean that the entire idea is devoid of meaning or purpose.
You always put it in such more eloquent words than I'm able to, Heidi, which is why I should just have a Heidi translator at me at all times when I just throw a bunch of...
It's an app.
Yes, just a bunch of gibberish out there. You're able to put it in such an eloquent way. You mentioned, and I agree, at the end of the day, I don't think this is some sort of... I hope it's not a hate-filled sort of thing. Maybe this is just a couple of guys just trying to either be funny or, you know, but there has to be, you know, rooted in what they are doing is saying it's mocking what the Pride Parade is all about. And it's also negating and I think diminishing the importance of it and to the texture as well. And I think a lot of that is unfortunately a byproduct of the great strides that the LGBT community has made over the years. I think there's something to be said for the more people that eye roll at the necessity of a pride parade, even if I believe they're wrong, might be because of the great victories the LGBT community has had to the point that some people say, well, is it even necessary anymore? I, of course, think it is, but, you know, maybe there is a silver lining in this that is, as people sort of poke fun at it or try and say, oh, now it's time for a straight, maybe there is some, it's rooted at least a little bit in sort of the progress that has been made.
No, that's really a good point. I mean, the fact that you were able to legally marry in Illinois or whatever state you wanted to legally marry in now is certainly progress. Now, does that mean that, you know, we live in a country where, you know, people are treated 100% equally, you know, regardless of their sexual orientation? No, but it's better than it was, you know, in 2005.
Right.
It's better than it was in 1965. It's, you know, it's getting better. I don't think, you know, it would be honest to say that it's not, but I also don't think it would be honest to say, like, well, you know, let's wash our hands of that topic.
Yes, we're all done.
You know,
set and settled.
Check that one off the list.
Well, and also,
there's still some work to do.
Yeah, and there is work to do currently. And also, I will say there are a few of my friends who are gay are posting, just ignore these guys. Don't make a thing of it. Part of me, half of me agrees with it. Like, why even give them the time of day? But the other half says, you know, a few years ago, I think a lot of people thought that racial tensions were a little bit more subdued than they were. And through the election of who we have as president and his some of his hate-filled rhetoric, or at least certainly incendiary rhetoric that can be taken certain ways, and you start to see bubbling up and what happens in Charlottesville and those things. Sometimes, you know, it is important, even if it just seems like a little thing in Boston. You know, I think there is some importance to nipping this sort of stuff in the bud and calling for it what it is.
At least having a discussion about it. I agree. I mean, I'm always on the side of like, well, let's talk about it. I mean, it does draw attention to something that otherwise might have been a Facebook post that nobody noticed. So in a way, you know, I guess we're giving these guys the platform that they want. On the other hand, like, you know, how we treat people who love differently than we do is a pretty big topic, and we should talk about it. And if this is giving us an opportunity, then, like, heck, let's take the opportunity.
You've got a really cool conversation coming up, Heidi, on June 20th. I'd buy tickets to the Heidi show no matter what it was, solo or not, but you're going to be chatting with a best-selling author. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah. So Jennifer Weiner, she's best known for what? Probably In Her Shoes, which was made into a Cameron Diaz movie, Good and Bad, a bunch of books. She's got a new one out called Mrs. Everything that's really, really good. It talks about her, well, it's, I won't give too much away. It's a great book. Anyway, she's coming to Chicago June 20th. We're going to be in conversation. So, get tickets if you can.
Did she write Good Night Nobody? Did you say that one?
No, I don't think so. Good and Bad.
Yeah, definitely.
I guess you would call her chick lit, but I think that's, you know, not quite,
right.
You know, it's a little dismissive. And,
yeah.
And Mrs. Everything is, you know, tells the story of a woman who grew up knowing that she was gay, but in an era where she certainly was not allowed to be. And so ended up marrying a man and then later in life realizing she couldn't stay married to a man. And she has daughters, it's a very, very layered, interesting, and also fun to read novel. So great book if you are looking for a novel, and should be a great event too.
Yep, the conversation is on June 20th, and Eventbrite has the tickets. And you can go to the Chicago Tribune, click on the columns on Heidi Stevens, and you've got a link there at the bottom of this column about the Straight Pride Parade. Heidi, thanks for joining us. As always, it's great to chat with you.
You too.
I owe you lunch or coffee or something, okay?
Okay.
All right. Thanks. WGN. Thank you very much, Steve. And joined by a special guest now, Tony Romanucci. And every time I say a good Italian name, Tony, I've got to like put my fingers up like that. It helps me with the pronunciation to say it. Tony, welcome to the program here today.
Well, luckily we're on the radio and they can't see all our hand gestures, right?
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, joking around here in the intro, but a serious discussion I want to have. And it's a fascinating legal debate with a horrific backdrop. Obviously, everyone remembers the Parkland shooting. It's fresh in our minds about a year and a half ago. It was last February, I believe.
Right.
17 children taken way too soon. We had David Hogan here a couple months ago and chatted with him. He's the student that's really risen to prominence in terms of his reaction to it and kind of trying to motivate young voters in this country. I digress, though. The security guard who was on duty, the school security officer, is being charged with child negligence, other charges along that lines. And, you know, this would be a max situation. I don't think we're going to see this. But if he's found guilty, could serve up to nearly 100 years in prison. I'm sure it wouldn't be that. They'd work out the sentencing. It struck me immediately, Tony, as kind of cruel. But your experience in this work, first of all, maybe introduce yourself, your firm, and how you have some experience in this sort of field.
So I'm an attorney with the firm of Romanucci and Blandon, and we concentrate our types of cases on very similar cases to what happened in Parkland. We help people who have been aggrieved by acts of torts, by negligence. And so we're involved in a case that many listeners might be aware of, the Pulse Orlando shooting, mm-hmm. that disaster, that catastrophe, horrific shooting where, you know, 50-some people were killed by that individual. So I'm aware of some of the issues that we have here. So I think part of the analysis that we have to have is, what was Officer Peterson supposed to be doing that day? Well, we know that he was a sworn police officer. We know that he was trained to possess a gun. So assumedly he was trained on that gun, went to the range, knew how to shoot it. Third, his job was a little bit more specific than being a patrol officer on the street. He was assigned to a school.
Specific zone, know where
Correct.
You're supposed to be. Yeah,
it's not like he's traveling off campus looking at, you know, looking to stop an armed robbery or burglary or even issue a traffic citation.
Right.
No, he had a specific job. He was trained. He was told to do specific work. And what do we know about what he did based on the video surveillance mm-hmm. and what other witnesses said? He didn't do his job. He was trained to be there to stop active shooters. He did not do that. We know that protocol has changed now since the beginning of time, mm-hmm. which is Columbine,
right.
of how active shooters are supposed to be engaged. You don't do what he said you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to stop and scan and assess,
set
and
up a perimeter,
pull back,
or anything
set
like
up
that.
A perimeter.
Yeah,
no, that's
in.
Not what you're supposed. You're supposed to go in, and God forbid. You're supposed to be a distraction for that shooter, to take away from the multiple lives, and you're supposed to. You are supposed to sacrifice your life for others. That's your sworn job as a police officer.
Is there much precedence in these sorts of cases of someone not meeting their, you know, what they were sworn to do, whether it's a school shooting or something similar in nature?
So let me answer it this way. In this criminal setting, I'm not aware of any. In a civil setting, it's been done before. People have filed lawsuits against police officers for failing to do their job. But I have to tell you, it's extremely difficult from a civil standpoint. There are immunities. I mean, like if we were to bring this lawsuit in Illinois,
mm-hmm.
if I were to sue a police officer for failing to do his job, I'd probably not succeed.
Yeah.
Right now, the way the laws are, we would fail.
Now, if it's that hard in civil court, with the burden of proof being even higher in a criminal court, these are really difficult cases to prove, because you've got to get in his mind at that moment, and he has claimed that he thought he was doing the right thing. That's hard to prove, because do you have to prove malice in it, or do you just have to prove unintentional, that he just didn't do the job straight up? I mean, what's the burden here that they have to surpass?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, you know, the burden that, you know, this prosecutor has right now is beyond a reasonable doubt. So what does he have to show? He has to show that these charges of neglect, of contributing to the harm of a child, that is so far above the standard that we're familiar with in a civil case, preponderance, which is it more probably
more than
true
half,
than
yeah,
not?
Right, right.
Yeah. So now, beyond a reasonable doubt, if Peterson's defense sets it up that, hey, I was protecting those kids, I thought that I was doing what I was trained to do, I, you know, pulled out my gun, I didn't see the shooter. If that defense sets up on that way, a reasonable, unbiased jury.
Right.
Okay, I said unbiased.
Right, which is hard to do in Florida right now, especially on this case or any case.
Really. I wouldn't want to be on trial on this case in Florida right now. An unbiased jury would have to say, you know, state, you have not met your burden.
And you need one person to say that and to really hold their ground.
You need all 12.
Oh, what I'm saying is you need one person to take his side on
oh,
this.
Oh, right,
sort of
yeah, you only need one person to hang that jury, yeah. Sure.
My other question is I imagine, and look, I totally get it. He had a bulletproof vest. He has a weapon. That's what he's sworn to do. And I'd love to think that me in that situation, now I'd never put myself in that situation swearing that oath to do that. And by him taking that oath, it puts him in a different circumstance. But is there any sympathy to be had? And I'm not asking you necessarily as a lawyer, but as a juror, I imagine that could be something the defense is going to go after too. Just imagine being in this harrowing situation. Something on the book, following the letter of the law or what you're supposed to do, is easier said than done when you hear bullets, when you fear for your own life. certainly a jury, at least one juror, can be swayed by that argument.
Oh, absolutely. If you want to take the bird's eye view of this whole scenario, Peterson can, he will be painted as a very sympathetic, actually savior type person.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you know, these parents, these children, this community wants justice. And the prosecutor is delivering to them a measure of justice. I don't know that they'll be successful, but maybe this community will heal somewhat from this. But the other thing that you don't want is also what lawyers are very fearful of, and anybody should be, and that's bad precedent.
Yeah. I gotta wonder too, the president, President Trump tweeted about this situation, about this guard, went as far as almost to calling him a coward, and then he kind of backed it. So I don't know necessarily about a coward, but did cowardly things in this moment. When you have the President of the United States weighing in, that certainly changes the dynamics of the case.
Oh, of course it does. It changes the dynamics incredibly, because when you look at, you know, the demographics of Florida, you know, we don't mm-hmm. need to go back to the year 2000, right? We don't
Let's
need to
not.
Do that.
Yeah.
But when you look at Florida demographics, Trump, depending on where you're located, is going to persuade people very heavily.
For sure.
So I don't know how this man is going to get a fair trial. And even though I'm on the side of representing victims, I want Peterson to get a fair trial mm-hmm. because I want everyone to get a fair trial. That's what we should all strive for. And what Trump did is unnecessarily insert himself in a situation where he has now created an unfair circumstance for Peterson.
He's done that in other cases as well, too. Probably should put the phone away just in a few different circumstances, just to say the least, but we'll move on from that. You're working on the case not only with the Pulse Nightclub, but with Las Vegas. These are challenging cases for you. Why? What drives you to take these cases on if they are so difficult?
Well, really, I mean, you know, when you take a case on like this, you're not doing it for anything but for the policy. I mean, there comes a certain point where I've reached a point in my practice and my age where you really want to be able to say that you've done something good, not just for only one person, but for an entire community. And by taking on these cases, that's the great hope. You know, Pulse Nightclub, you know, what can you say about that, you know, horrific tragedy, except that somebody was handed, literally, they were handed a gun license to purchase massive amounts of ammunition and guns, long guns, semi-automatics, to do one thing, kill.
The security firm you're referring to.
The security firm, which was G4S. You know, it's really, for me, as just a human being, not even a lawyer, it's just hard for me to understand why anyone would have access to one of these long guns
mm-hmm.
As opposed to even 10 of them, 20 of them, or in the Las Vegas case, 33 of them. Why? There's only one purpose: mass destruction, killing of people. We're not hunting with these weapons. We're only doing it for the killing of people. We're not using them for self-protection. We're totally going the opposite way of the Second Amendment. So that's why, you know, lawyers take these cases on and fight the way that they do, hoping for change.
In Las Vegas, you talk a little bit about the case that you're working on with them.
Well, in Las Vegas, that was the instance where, you know, the shooter in that case, with the help of the Mandalay Bay Hotel, was assisted up to his room carrying 33 guns and thousands of rounds of ammunition.
Now, they're going to say it was obviously in containers and they'd have no idea what was going on. What do you guys contend? That they should have known, should have checked more, should have checked baggage?
Well, I'm going to answer that question just a little bit circuitously.
Okay, please do. Yeah, I don't know if I'm going in areas I'm not supposed to be going.
Oh, no,
yeah.
You're going in areas
I'll
where
keep on going, yeah.
You should be asking these questions, but what needs to be known about what Mandalay Bay knew that we found out that they failed to disclose was that about 18 months before this particular shooting, there was another active shooter in that building.
Really?
Mandalay Bay was on notice that the Strip, as putting aside any personal bias, as Steve Wynn predicted 6 years ago, that the Las Vegas Strip was probably the highest soft target on this nation's hit list.
So you would contend that these hotels were negligent in not having security measures in place to anticipate something like this, even if they didn't know specifically that that gentleman walked in with weapons?
100% correct. Because, and here's why, when Steve Wynn made that prediction, he actually did something about it. He just didn't talk about mm-hmm. it and say that we all need to be on notice. He actually implemented the platinum standard security measures in his hotels. You'd never see them. The gambler, the person who's dining, they would never see those mm-hmm. security measures that he has in place.
That'd be me. I'd be at the craps table having no idea what was happening elsewhere.
Heck no. You wouldn't see who's behind you watching you at all.
You could say that right for sure.
And those other hotels didn't take the same measures.
Yeah.
So somebody raised the bar. The others failed to take those measures. And you, what's the result is tragedy, mm-hmm. such as what happened on Route 91.
Tony, do you have any, obviously the case involving Scott Peterson isn't one that you're working on, which means that I can ask you this question. What is your anticipation of how this is going forward? Do you think we might have a plea between the two parties, reach a settlement, or do you think that this is something that this prosecutor wants to bring to a trial?
Well, I think the prosecutor knows. Look, the prosecutor has to know what a difficult challenge he has. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, he charged under a statute that's not even meant for police officers. It's meant for parents. It's meant for caregivers.
Caregivers, right, because that was part of the argument of whether he really falls into this caregiver category.
He's not a caregiver. I don't know under what definition he could become a caregiver, but maybe I'm not the smartest guy, you know, here either.
You're in this room, guy in this room. I'll tell you that much. Well, there's only two of us, so.
So if you were to ask for my wild prediction, I would see that there's going to be a carve-out of a charge that is as close as possible to what this man may have committed, and there's going to be a plea. I don't know how this man's going to get a fair trial. I don't know if the community is going to tolerate a trial where he could be found not guilty. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say there's going to be a carve out of some non-jail time for him. It's going to be more than a slap on the wrist, and he will be the fall guy for it.
Tony Romanucci, founding partner at Romanucci and Blandon, and thanks for. Did you walk over? Or did you get in a cab? It's a nice day out. It's a little hot though.
I walked.
Yeah,
I'm going to take advantage of this. Are you kidding?
I mean, you're over on Clark Street, so you ain't too far away.
I walked. It's warm in Chicago.
Yeah, you better believe it. Tony, it's a difficult conversation, but thanks for breaking it down for
me. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
WGN. Just a few more minutes left here on the John Williams Show. John Hanson in until 3 o'clock. Then we got Rowan Anna and the White Sox wrap on up. Everyone will join hands and join the mothership one more time. But you're listening everywhere, streaming live from Chicago. Ella, some fascinating conversations today, whether it's a straight pride parade or the conversation about the active shooter situation. I don't know. That one's really tough for me. And I don't know if it's just because I always find the sympathetic side of things. But, or at least I hope to, or maybe I should be tougher on that guy. I don't know. It's really easy to say you're a sworn officer and you will run into the fire and you will, and I have a family of first responders and I imagine they would all do the same thing and be able to help mitigate that sort of situation or at least do their best, even if it meant risking their own life. But man, that is tough to say what you're going to do until you're in that situation.
Yeah, but I also think you should know yourself well enough to not apply to that job or not be in law enforcement mm-hmm. if you're not going to act.
To the point of going to jail if you don't?
Right.
I think it also plays a part with the whole training aspect.
Yeah.
We're not training officers well enough because they should know what it feels like to be in that situation by that point.
That's an interesting point. So maybe if there is some litigation to be had, maybe not against the individual, but about the department, maybe their training policies need to be revised. I think at the end of the day, you know, throwing another person in jail, I don't know what that's going to help anyone, but maybe feel better for five more minutes. And is that worth it then? I think, Lauren, you're hitting on something important there, that maybe what needs to come out of this is a complete reexamination of who our school resource officers are. I don't remember. I think we had actual, I shouldn't say actual. I think we had members. I went to Downers Grove South High School. I think we had members of the Downers Grove Police Department in our school so that they were active, engaged members of the police force as opposed to, resource officers. I also went to school. I was in high school when Columbine happened. So I don't know if everything's completely changed with the landscape of who our resource officers are, whether they are police officers. I mean, they all must be trained, as you heard Tony talking about, in this sort of thing. But yeah, until you're in that moment, Elif, I err on the side of forgiving someone because, you know, that guy, I mean, and people say, oh, he had a bulletproof vest. Yeah, well, if he gets shot in the head, it ain't going to help you, you know?
Right, yeah.
And that part, I don't know about anything about this Scott Peterson, this resource officer. I'm sure he has maybe a wife, family to go home to. It's really easy to say, go in there and do it. But I don't know if we should be holding people criminally responsible. But I think Lauren brings up a great point there with the training.
There are definitely worse people that should be in jail than...
Yeah, exactly. And I don't want to bring in the Jason Van Dyke situation. I forget what the exact sentence was, but 6.5 years and he actively shot someone. And that's going to open up a whole can of worms on which side of the fence you're on with that sort of situation. All I'm saying is that this guy could go to jail, theoretically, I don't think it'll end up like this, for like 90-something years. Because he set up a perimeter instead of running into a line of fire. And I don't know if that's, I don't know if we should be expecting, like, I think that why don't we spend more time fixing the root of the problem of why our schools are getting shot up versus being mad at the resource officer for not running into the line of fire. I don't know. Throw some congressmen in jail. That'll motivate him to make some changes. Ooh, Elif, I'm fired
up.
Wow, you
are
this
fired
show.
Up. Dang.
I was so calm the whole
you
show.
You just hit us with the throw the congressman in jail for that. Dang.
I know. I had a great story about D-Day and how the story was almost leaked. I think I might be able to get to it. Really quickly, though, the news click from yesterday, Adam Strauss. I don't know anything about this story, Elif, by the way, your news click from yesterday. Adam Strauss talks about taking mushrooms to treat his OCD in The Mushroom Cure. And A is, if it really helps lessen the symptoms, I'd do it. That came at 34%. B, I would try all other methods before resorting to drugs if I had an issue like OCD. That came in at 27%. Or C, I'd never be caught dead taking psychedelic drugs for this problem. And that was our winner, the plurality, at 39%. Kind of split between A and C, but really a good question. Spread it out all over all three answers.
It's a hard question to ask because you have to have OCD to know the answer.
Yeah, and you know what? If it's a plant and it helps you with your life, do it. That's what I always say.
Okay.
I'm fired up. Put the congressman in jail.
Yeah.
That's a good way to end any show. Today's news click question, talking about the straight pride parade in Boston, this effort underway to hold this parade. Do you think, A, it's a good idea? Everyone deserves to have a parade.